Are there like going to be Game of Thrones moments in this?
Oh, interesting.
In terms of like power struggles?
Are you going to ask me if there's going to be like a little cake that's going to try to murder Lou's character?
I don't know.
Why would I tell you that? Maybe just watch. Maybe just find out. What if both EXU Calamity and A Court of Fan Flowers were just about trying to backstab Lou Wilson's character?
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Geek Peek. Today, I'm interviewing Abria Iyengar about A Court of Fae and Flowers. This is a republished version of the original YouTube video that I made. Before we head into it, please click the subscribe button wherever you are watching or listening to this conversation. And without further ado, enjoy the interview.
Abria, thank you so much for being here.
Hello!
It's amazing to have you.
Oh my gosh, I'm so happy to be here. Look, longtime viewer. I'm so excited.
Yes. And like every interview in Dimension 20, I start with the same question. And I have it for you as well. What's the inspiration behind this season?
Oh, this season, I really wanted to take a lot of things that are happening in like the cultural zeitgeist around Bridgerton and the reinvestment of like romantic storylines and period pieces, all of which that have been very popular for a long time, but we're kind of seeing new spins and new takes on Regency and the sort of dance of propriety and kind of kick its butt and put it into D&D and one of my favorite settings and ideas, which is like the Fae Realms and the Feywild. So I just really wanted to make my friends from D20 and some friends that I was bringing over to D20 be in love and do romance for me while I watched. That's all it is, and it's great.
It's amazing. I love that. There was one question, like people conspired in the Discord and on YouTube, like people don't know how Calamity happened, and now we have this season, 10 episodes.
Yes.
Can you tell us what went on behind the scenes? How they were like managed? Were there overlap?
Oh my goodness. So there was a bit of overlap between the two seasons. And I think my favorite part was the extraordinary mood whiplash of going from Calamity, which was that very short burst, super intense tragedy, held with like the tension and intensity that Brennan does so well. And then like days later being like, okay, Lou, Brennan, come over to my game and there's flowers everywhere and we're going to talk about our feelings. So it was very fun. And they're both like, the nice thing is like, there's different kinds of intensity and there is that like existential threat intensity in Calamity. And then when you really think about when we tell stories in Regency about like society and propriety, there is that like existential threat that also runs through Jane Austen books, even though it seems gentler and it's surrounded by like pastures and flowers and balls and like ruffly dresses. Those like love matches and trying to find people and do the best for your family and your own reputation and your society writ large. Those are existential threats, but just to like idle rich. So it has some of the same like interesting themes, but they just felt very different. And it was buck wild doing them. There was some minor overlap. And then just like in those, some of those last days, we're just like, okay, well, this was a great episode. I'll see the two of you in 20 minutes over at D20. Goodbye.
Wow. Yeah. The energies from Calamity and then like going into shooting this. Oh my God.
Yeah, it was crazy. I will say there's like one specific like week of my life that might be my favorite gaming I've ever done because it was like, it was a little bit of both and just like very intense. And obviously, I would read the phone book with Lou and Brennan. So my best possible life is spending a ton of time with them and just telling stories in their world. So it was great.
That's amazing. I love this so much. Okay. How do you call it? Sorry, not a native English speaker.
No, you're good.
The thing is that the word that I'm looking for is...
Or you know, I do this all the time as a GM, right? Where I'm like, oh, no, my whole job is one word. I just have to have this one word and it's gone. That happens. You're good. Take your time.
Thank you so much. Okay. Okay. So there is a system in the game that in this season that you are using called Good Society.
Yes.
And I want to talk about it, but before I talk about it, I want to talk about the world building.
Yeah.
Of this season. What can you tell us about how you built this world? What is the kind of person who is going to benefit the most, or on the other spectrum, like who is not going to survive in this world?
Yeah. My favorite thing about building this world was that sort of idea of we have to be playing with class and status and all of those things. Like when we look at these kind of stories and these books and movies, like we're looking at a very rarefied class. These people that are born into money and with very little effort are going to be able to maintain their station. So for me, the perfect analog for that, porting into the system was kind of looking at the Archfey. So we're looking across the Fey realms and in the world that I've developed here, the Fey realms have lots of different factors. There's courts. There are people who reject and defy the idea of a court system, but all of these Fey that are normally quite immortal, they can be killed. They're not impervious, but if left to their own devices, are immortal. Like you're able to build these like grand like courts and societies and structures. So we are looking for our game at the Archfey of a bunch of different courts that normally kind of stay away from each other and hold to their own devices. So like Court of Stone or the Court of Seafoam or the Court of Deepwater, all of these different kinds of Fae who normally stay and do their own thing will come together for this like magical event called the Bloom, which is like a resurging of magic through this and all realms. So they kind of just get together, party for an amount of time. I love playing with the idea. And this is actually like a little callback to my EXU season last year where Ashley Johnson as Fern declared that time is a weird soup. And I was like, I'm going to remember that forever. So time to the Fae doesn't mean very much. So this is for just sort of an amount of time. It's a couple weeks that happens every, not regularly, every few like centuries. But again, what is time to an immortal Fae? And they just sort of get together and they form new alliances and hang out and party too hard and get into trouble and go away. So it does very much feel like the thing I built is fantasy Coachella. And that's the first time I've had that thought and I regret it a little bit, but everyone will hang out, get together, get into trouble, and then they go away with all of the stuff that they've done to each other and connections that they've made, and wait for the next bloom.
Amazing. Okay, you describe it in such a great, enticing way.
Thank you.
Okay. I want to talk about Good Society. You're using Good Society alongside D&D 5e.
Yes.
How did that work out?
So I will tell you about the thought process behind it and then how it kind of went down. So Good Society is actually, I might give it the title of my favorite system to play in. Okay. I adore it. The first time I played it was with my gaming group, like the Salt Bays, and it was run by Vanna Mahoney. And she's amazing and made me like fall in love with this system that is very like, there's not conflict, there's resolve tokens, you have phases of play, and it really quickly drops you into the cadence and priorities of a Regency story. So you spend a phase writing letters, and that's how you move the story forward. You're like, okay, I'm gonna send the letter here. I'm going to demand a letter and like a response here. And via like the novel phase and the actual like, gameplay and the like rumors that you spread and the reputations that you hold and the letters that you send, you're able to put together this really intriguing story that makes sense for its theme and type. And I've wanted to do something with it for a while. I think it didn't port over as is. I don't think it ported over perfectly. So I wanted to kind of bash in some. So there's plot. This game, despite me going, it's just everyone kissing each other, there is a plot. So I needed some like conflict mechanics to kind of break in. So it was a matter of sort of taking my favorite things from Good Society and adding them in and layering them on top of 5e, which everyone at the table was comfortable with and confident with. There's also that struggle of asking players to tell stories in systems that they're not necessarily familiar with. Like we did it for Misfits and Magic, and again, a testament to excellent players rolling with it. But I wanted to give as a baseline, since the kind of story we were telling was so different from the normal stories that we tell at that table at Dimension 20, I wanted to add a little bit of a baseline of something comfortable to fall back on. Like, we all know what an insight check is. We all know what a wisdom save is. We're going to see, like, spells and abilities that people are familiar with as, like, they have standard D&D 5e classes. Now, as for how well those two systems played together, it's a little crazy, but you could just tell that like they tell very different kinds of stories. So there's a little bit of like the holding both systems' hands and going, play well together so we could tell a weird story. So it went really well. It was just an interesting practice in trying to see how like, I'm not going to say like diametrically opposed systems work together, but there's certainly, they have different priorities. It was interesting to try to get those two different systems to try to tell like one cohesive story together. But we did it, and it was amazing and so fun.
Amazing. Okay. I love so much that you have three experienced D&D 5e players on your table.
Yeah.
And you challenge them, like, and in Good Society, like using Good Society. And also, like, I remember Brennan said that too, in Starstruck, that that system was also like D&D 5e, but with a twist. Yes. Of, so yeah, that's so amazing. I love like the little bit of challenge.
Right?
Yeah, it's amazing.
D&D is not a universal system. Sorry to cut you off. D&D is not a universal system, but it's so good at like taking on like a little bit of stank from other things. And it's really easy to kind of craft it and tweak it to tell the kind of story you want. And that was a conversation Brendan and I had before, because I was watching Starstruck Odyssey, and just like kind of just being like, oh, wait, you did something kind of interesting there. What's that about? And that definitely helped me feel bolder about going like, okay, well, now I'm going to mash together two of my favorites and we'll see how it goes. So, yeah, shout out to Brennan for inspiring a little bit of mashup for this.
Okay. I would love to ask you a lot more questions, but people sent me questions and I think I'll just have to like go over them, because most of them also coincide with my own questions that I wanted to ask you. So let's start with the first one. Will there be physical sets this season? Not exactly. That was in the FAQ.
Yes.
Can you explain what not exactly means?
Oh, man, I want to leave this as tantalizing as possible. But what do I say? There are so many things. So much about this season is about mood and being able to, like, buy into your surroundings and the priorities of this game. So while there are not traditional battle sets where we move and we have like a little grid laid down, there are like settings and scenes and pieces that Rick Perry and Mario and the whole team worked on that are deeply evocative, but we leave most of like the conflict resolution and encounter building to theater of the mind in order to keep people up and mobile in the space instead of kind of focusing on the adjudication of battle maps. So really my answer is, I'm not gonna explain it. There's stuff everywhere. I made Rick Perry buy so many flowers and little things, and they're everywhere. Mm. But battle sets are not quite a part of it.
Okay, so I'll ask a question that is probably the most like expected one. Are there stuff in the table and around it that the players can find and use?
Yes. So I wanted to have a little bit of a like, there's physicality and things to interact with. So if you see in the trailer, they all have like these little like boxes in front of them. And it becomes like a fun little note to see what part of, and like, I love playing with the meta. And it started with our little wands in Mismatch.
Yes.
And then got to in the holiday episode where I was like, what if we rip the back off the dome and do some shadow stuff in the back and play with player versus character expectations? And then we got to this season and I was like, I want to blur the line in a really fun way between like what your character is doing and feeling and thinking and seeing versus what you as the person at the table is interacting with. So the things that they see, there is interactivity in like a fun little way that like exists in the world that just, I just wanted everyone to feel delighted. And I think that's so much a part of like the Fae realms, that they are realms of delight and surprise. So trying to bring that and be a little evocative of that at the table is absolutely a part of it.
Amazing. I like, you killed me with your tweet. Like, Rick Perry, I need all the flowers.
All of them. When I tell you, we had so many production meetings that were just like, what do you think of these flowers? At some point, I do remember like being overwhelmed. He's so good. And all of the art department crushed it. At some point, I was like, hey, I didn't do this much flower work for my wedding. Oh my goodness. Yes. Give me all of them and do cool stuff in the background behind me. And then walking onto the set the first day, I was like, oh my God, he really did just bankrupt every Michaels in the tri-state area. We have all of the flowers. And I stole some at the end of the shoot. So I have a big bin of just plant life and I don't know what to do with it because I'm not crafty. But now it's my joke that like, I was like, okay, one of these days, if I can trick them to letting me back in the dome again, I will do a season that's just all battles. So I can finally walk in and be like, Rick, you've been so patient with me. Let's make some battle maps now and just watch him go, thank God, you are insane. Please just let me make a battle map.
Oh, that's so good. Okay, another question that a lot of people ask. Abria, 2 exclamation points. What is your flowchart method? I want details.
All right. Look, I've avoided talking about it, but here for you, here and now, let's talk about it. So for me, flowchart making, and most of my flowchart making started, or at least got like, not perfected, but really heightened during the 7, because Reika was playing a Battlemaster fighter and had so many options with maneuvers that I could kind of see her going like, oh, what can I add? So I was like, oh, hold on, let me just write you a little flow. So because there was no magic involved, it was really easy. There was just like the thing you, so for me, when I make a flowchart, I always put, and I make them more for my villains and enemies and encounters than I do for myself as a player. Cause not to be brag, like I play a lot of D&D, and I don't need a ton of reminders. Usually for me, my reminder is the thing I have to do at the top of the encounter. So at the top of all of my flowcharts, it's the thing you do when the encounter starts. So is that if that's like rage as a barbarian, you never want to forget to rage. Hunter's Mark, I always forget to Hunter's Mark. all of your hexes if you're a warlock, all of those things you want to put into place up top. So you're like giving yourself like your max efficacy across all of your turns. And then past that, like the just sort of like, what's your basic hit? And then like, if you're a newer player, just writing like the D20 plus whatever like your modifier is under it. And then like, if it's a hit, going down and like having little reminders for damage, ways to like add on to your damage. So I usually put like, if you hit, and then like under that, all the things you can add on the stunt. So like if you're a paladin, this is where you add in your smites, fighters, adding in maneuvers and things that you can do to like stack damage, reminders to add your damage from your persistent effects like rage or hex or hunter's mark. And then usually like a little flow back up to the top if you're using multi-attack. So it's like, do that, good, do it again. And then below that, I kind of like write a little line and I've got like other bonus action things. This is good because I think for me personally, especially when I play bards, I forget that even if I don't have bonus action spells, that's when you get in with like bardic inspiration. That's when you go and double check some of your features and traits to see if you can throw something else on that can give a buff to the group in an important way. And then, yeah, like keeping a little area at the bottom for reactions that, you know, you can use technically on your turn, but mostly like before your next turn starts and interrupt. So having that kind of at the bottom as a reminder. I like to have little check marks on the side. Well, for me, it's actually on the left side because I'm left-handed and I do look at everything that way. But where I'll usually check off if I have a concentration spell up. So I'll remember not to cast another con spell to negate that. Or just to remind myself to be careful with my placement on the battlefield so I'm not getting hit and getting forced to do concentration saves. So con saves to make sure I can maintain my spell. So I usually have that in the corner. And then my favorite thing in the world, and this is the thing I do actually do for myself, is I keep a whammy, which is on the right side of the page. And is like the, if you get your perfect turn order, everything works out right. Mm-hmm. What's the biggest hit you can make? Like what's the good spell stack that stacks with another thing and like has all the pieces is in place to do the most damage you can do. I had my whammy built out for Calamity. I had one built to survive if either Sarit or Xerxes came after me in a PvP scene. And then I built one going into the final fight that I only got to use part of because of the way the kind of final fight went, and I won't explain it too much for spoilers, but I was able to use Tasha's otherworldly guys, but there was some other stuff that I could have stacked with it, but it didn't come up, and that's okay. But it's nice to like have it and to see it and to be kind of maneuvering yourself during the encounter to try to give yourself that one big hit, that like beautiful Babe Ruth called shot. And those are my flowcharts. It's really not that, like, they're not that special. Everyone's being very nice about it, but they're just reminders of like, don't forget to do your like cool abilities. And here's just a generalized, like, don't forget you hit multiple times. Here's your bonus actions. D&D Beyond's actually really, really good about having them on there. But sometimes if you just like things written down a little spatially that you can kind of just look and go at a glance, I understand that even if I get distracted and I don't know what's going on and the battle gets super like weird and complicated and I can't figure out the best possible thing to do, here's my list of like exactly what I can do every time. And even if it's just like I hit, I add my normal maneuver that adds some more damage, I hit again, good, that's my turn and I did my job, and that feels really good.
That's amazing. As a software engineer, I relate to that a lot.
You get it.
I get it. Okay, amazing. Here's a question that you don't have to answer if you don't want to. Doubtful she'll answer it, but I'm always wondering what classes the characters are playing before I get to watch the first episode.
Ooh, you know I'm not going to answer. But I will tell you one class that they're not playing, if that makes you feel any better. We will not see a monk.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I never want to, like, the only reason I wouldn't answer is it's kind of, I never want to take away a player's, like, opportunity to share information about their characters. So, I mean, by all means, go bother the other players on social media. If they want to tell you, totally fine. It's not my place as a DM to take their shine away. But there won't be any monks. Is that true? Did I lie? I said that with the confidence I don't actually feel. There's no monks. We're fine.
Okay.
We're fine.
We'll discover it when the episode airs. Okay. Was there a big difference for you in preparing for this campaign, Fae and Flowers, compared to the one you ran last year, Misfits and Magic?
Oh, 100%. If only for the fact that, like, I got 2.5 times more episodes. So we're now, like, we're going from 4 episodes to 10. We're telling something in, like, a more conflict-based system. Misfits and Magic, like, Kids on Brooms is a system, is very good about, like, making you feel like a little kid in, like, that magical school isekai, but doesn't love conflict. Like, it resolves it really quickly and moves on. Like, if you fight, you stomp or get stomped and you kind of move on with your day. So the added complexity of, let's tell this, like, incredibly emotionally driven story. And I can talk, I think, for hours about the, like, prep for, like, getting a table on board with, hey, are you down to explore, like, big feelings in a big way and go on arcs? And a lot of that can feel very intense and very emotional, depending on how much you buy in. It's also really hard as a GM to try to guess where people's feelings are going to go. Like, there's one thing to say, like, well, here's the plot that's going to underwrite all of it, and they'll follow it however they follow it. There's another, and the thing I really wanted to challenge myself with for this one was putting a lot more in the players' hands, because that's how good society feels. Like, you generally understand your personal objectives, and then you are given, like, these novel phases of play to try to, like, execute on them. Bringing that into this game was a really big trust exercise on my end of going, like, there are going to be phases of play that you dictate, and I will be sitting and taking so many notes, jumping in where I can as an NPC, but you guys are going to tell me where you want to go, and then we're going to, like, come back together and then move the story forward as a group. But there has to be that sense of, like, extraordinary agency when you are talking about Archfey, when you're talking about, like, the rich and powerful in a society. They have to kind of make big decisions and decide for themselves what they want and what they're going to choose to pursue. So a lot of the prep for this was going, like, how do we give them the tools and opportunity and encouragement to make big choices when they're playing in a system that sort of presupposes that the dungeon master is going to walk you through a story? So most of my prep was around the, like, philosophy of storytelling in these two sort of disparate systems, and then giving some, like, general rails of, like, here's where the world's at now. How do I empower you to tell your story throughout it? Which was cool and hard.
Yeah. One thing that that occurred to me during your, like, explaining that, are there, like, going to be Game of Thrones moments in this?
Oh, interesting.
In terms of, like, power struggles?
Are you going to ask me if there's going to be, like, a little cake that's going to try to murder Lou's character? I don't know. Why would I tell you that? Maybe just watch. Maybe just find out. What if both EXU Calamity and A Court of Fae and Flowers were just about trying to backstab Lou Wilson's character? He gets stabbed in the back so much, and it's very funny. It's very good. So, okay. I don't know. We'll see.
Okay, amazing. You're one of my favorite DMs. Your energy is immaculate. Anywho, how are you able to stay on track and narrate while also letting your players go full chaos mode? P.S. All of your looks are aesthetic as heck.
Oh my gosh, thank you. Wow, a good hard question. I just, I love and respect the people that I am lucky enough to play and tell these stories with so much that there is a lot of, like, the hardest part of this is doing the, like, you all, like, I want you guys to do what you want to do. And yes, that comes off as, like, inherently extraordinarily chaotic. But I think kind of falling back on, like, my improv training of going, like, whatever you give, I'm going to trust that it's going to make some kind of sense. And I'm going to spend my time sort of bending the world around the things that you've decided are true and important and powerful to you as a player and you as a character. So it really just sort of feels like conforming the world to the player's whims. So, like, I can sit and spend weeks and months coming up with, like, a massive world and a bunch of plots, but if that's not what the characters care about, we're not going to have a good time. It's going to be bad to be at the table. It's going to be bad to watch. So really the fun part of my job at the table is going, like, oh, is that what you like? Okay, fine. I'm just going to just kind of mush this part. Look, it was always part of the plan. Here you go. Yeah, it's stressful, but very fun. And then when you get those, like, transcendent moments of, like, the story meeting the storyteller, and I mean storyteller as, like, PC and game runner, the story meeting the storyteller in that, like, one perfect moment where you're like, man, it feels like we planned it. And I know none of us did. So we're all feeling that, like, surprise and joy, and you can see it on their faces in that moment when it happens. Like, that's the thing I tell stories in RPGs for. Like, you feeling that feels so good. Like, yeah, you can go home and just write a book. You can go and write a script and write a movie and write a play. But there's something in the, like, improvisational nature of RPGs when mechanics meet story, meet world, that and meet the players where they are, that just feels so good. The dopamine, I love it forever. And thank you for the compliment. The looks are wild this go around, and it was really fun because I didn't see, like, half of them, because a lot of them were finished when I was in the chair doing the, like, last minute prep before we started. So I never saw myself until we started, like, doing the edit, and I was like, oh, interesting. The crown, the moss was bigger than I remember. Interesting. Okay. But it's all incredibly cool, and shout out to Denise Valentine for absolutely crushing the looks. I love her.
Wow. First of all, what you said earlier, like, about the intersection between, like, the storytelling and, like, the dopamine hits, this makes me so much more excited about this season, because, like, it's not just a book that you can, like, skip forward. It's like human interaction, and I love that.
It's so good. They're so good. I just can't overstate how good everyone at the table is. Like, for those of you that, like, are already D20 stands, like, you already know how good how good Axford and Lou and Brennan are. You see them do it season after season. They're consistently excellent, and that's amazing. And I'm so excited for you to meet our new players. I was honored to play with Oscar for the first time. Omar and Serena are both very good friends of mine, and just everyone crushes it. Like, it's so wild to see people, like, just show up and be like, we absolutely understand the assignment, and then just serve on it and fire on all cylinders for 10 episodes in a row. It's just, oh, it's so cool. I just went home every night after the thing, like, they're so good. Okay, let's go home. We just have to match them. We just rise to meet them. They're so good.
Amazing. Because you're a player and DM who travels to many platforms instead of having just one home base, are there any stylistic trademarks that you try to bring to every campaign?
Ooh, fun. I think I am now sort of getting known for, like, the mashup. I brought in some Blades in the Dark to the EXU campaign, EXU Kymel. The original Mismag, like, we added in the, like, common fucking sense die. So I think if there's any stylistic thing that I am known for, it is that sort of, like, the wandering Ronin with no home of her own, kind of taking a little bit of everything that she's seen and experienced, and I've, like, learned about and played in and loved, and trying to mash in as much as possible to tell exactly the kind of story we've agreed to tell in that moment at that table, and letting each story be unique. And if that means we're running it in just one system that maybe people aren't familiar in, that's cool. Maybe it's something that's a little more like, yeah, we're running it in D&D, but we're going to add this like extra little bit so we hit the vibe of and like the tone and the theme of the story that we want to tell. So I hope that's it. Maybe it's just chaos and me screaming "Let's go" a lot. Either way,
let's go.
Let's go.
I just love the fact that sometimes I open up Twitter or like any other news website and I see that there's another thing by Abria that I can watch now. So yeah.
I keep making stuff until they learn to kick me out. I'm going to make everyone sick of me.
Okay, here's a fun one. It has been said that the 7 was the horniest season of Dimension 20. If the new season is evoking Bridgerton, will it be hornier? Additionally, who would be in your Dimension 20 all-star party, and what previous setting would you like to DM them in?
Oh my gosh, amazing. Okay, interesting. I think the 7 is still the horniest because I think teenagers in general are a level of horny that their chemicals and their proximity to adulthood and independence make them that like no one can match. I will never be more out of pocket horny and psychotic than I was as a 17-year-old girl. Having said that, I think there is, because this is a mature season, there is horniness in it, absolutely. But it's also everything that you get tied into and expect. It's so much like romantic and expectations and like horniness as subversion of like expectation and propriety. So yeah, it is a horny season. I love that stuff. But it definitely has like nuance and context to it that like matches the theme of the season. But yeah, still horny. If I could go back and do, I think I've talked about this before. I love A Crown of Candy. Look, I love all the seasons, but I love A Crown of Candy. If I could go back, I would take the intrepid heroes and of course like kick Brennan over and make him a player and put him in the peril that he put that whole table in and just run like a brutal season of like, you guys didn't want to do PvP. I demand it. Like, I love PvP. You guys are going to kill each other for our pleasure. That's going to be fun for us. So, yeah, I would go back and do a super brutal Crown of Candy. Maybe go see the Meatlands a little more. I think I would, yeah, like, shift the focus over there a little bit. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, the Meatlands were, like, a place that a lot of people wanted to go to. Like,
yeah.
And it always, like, hinted, but we never. Okay. What was it like to have Brennan and Emily as PCs at the same table?
Terrifying. Terrifying. It's terrifying. So I have wanted to play with Emily for so long. And then I realized once we got the table outlay, I was like, I got my wish. Oh no. I have watched and delightedly cackled as she has fully womped Brennan before. And I was like, oh, how fu-. Oh, I'm Brennan now. Oh, no, I will be the womp. Interesting. And I remember the first time she pulled up. She's just hyper intelligent and fun. That and like creative in that way where it's like, yes, of course, this is exactly how these like abilities and spells intersect and interact. But I didn't see that coming. And there are very few things that I genuinely don't see coming. And I remember the first time she caught me off guard and I was like, huh? Oh, yes. Yes, this is who you are. There was something about looking into her beautiful eyes and going, that's the face of the person that is actively killing me right now. Delightful. I asked for this. It's great. She's amazing. Brennan, I will play in anything. Like, if he's anywhere near dice, I can feel the disturbance in the forest and I will teleport there. Incredible. Lou, who is, I think people sleep on Lou a little bit because he is brilliant, but in that way of like, if you need a moment, I will absolutely come in and like crush it in. the economy of his like badassness. Like he's like, yeah, I'm going to give you exactly what you need. It's going to take like four words and then I'm done and I'm out. Smile, like mild tangent. I have seen the movie Nope twice. And Daniel Kaluuya is so good in it. And he says 11 words the entire movie. And I think that economy of like being extraordinarily good in acting, but it's reserved and it's just exact, it's the exact amount you need exactly when you need it, I think is like Lou's level of brilliance. And like, obviously, you're gonna meet Oscar and Serena and Omar, and I could talk about them a ton, but I want to reserve judgment for you to just sort of be delighted by them when you meet them at first. But that table was killer, and I am lucky to have been able to foster the story that we told.
I'm so excited for this now.
Me too.
Okay, last question, and then we'll wrap this up. What was your favorite part of running a campaign in the Feywild? Also, how do you encourage more social roleplay in your games?
Ooh, it was so lovely to go to the Feywild and say, like, things don't have to mean exactly what they mean. Like, this isn't quite the Feywild. It's the Fey Realms. Like, it's slightly abstracted away. But it's the idea of, like, the moment you move into Fey Realms where time doesn't mean as much and spatial relations and, like, space means different things and their relationship to magic means something different, you can kind of untether it from D&D exists in that sort of, like, medieval Western European society and theme and tone and time frame. You can get to the Feywild and say, like, we can pull from, like, modernity. We can pull from, like, ancient civilizations, Rome and Greece. Like, the only through line is that idea of, like, decadence and hedonism. But that is time period agnostic. So it was really fun, like, sort of giving the player brief that was, like, you don't have to do this in, like, a D&D time frame or D&D world. Think of what you think of when you think of like extraordinary luxury and excess and decadence and whatever that time period is, pull from it. We're also not doing good society straight out of the tin. So this isn't tied to like Regency or Victorian England. Pull from wherever you want to pull from. All of that's valid in a place like the Fey Realms. And if you want to make something new in this space too, there's room and space and like joy in that. So build what you will was extraordinarily fun to do. And I don't remember the second part of the question. I'm so sorry, I'm ADHD.
What was your favorite part of running a campaign in the Feywild? And also, how do you encourage more social roleplay in your games?
Oh my goodness, I love social roleplay so much. A lot of that comes down to like in session zero, discussing with the group and going like, this is a social game. There will be conflict and sometimes those conflicts will be like adjudicated with dice and initiative. But for the most part, your fights are verbal and they are posturing and they are the conversations you have and the moments you have interpersonally with each other, with your respective courts, with NPCs you meet in the field. So everything will be settled on that field of battle. And again, when you have improvisers and everyone's like a trained killer of an improviser, you can kind of just fall back on like, I don't need to have you make a persuasion roll or a deception check. You're just going to do it with your words. And it's going to be like the dice can be absolutely hands off. Like, can you convince me playing as the antagonist against you in this scene? Cool. Then you just did it. Like we can take a lot of that off the table and let our words be our weapon. And I think there's something about like setting your expectations up top and allowing for like the actual gameplay to reinforce that and let it kind of build its own momentum that like once you start doing it, everyone goes like, oh, well, I can have like this little like verbal moment. And then everyone gets bought in and then it just becomes a matter of as a storyteller, like grabbing on and holding that tone and letting them like stay once you've gotten them into the pocket of the kind of interactions you want to have, letting them do it and encouraging them to do it more.
Amazing. Abria, these were all the questions I had for you.
This was so fun. Thanks for hanging out with me.
This was amazing. I love this so much. And I'm so excited for this season now.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
I think Like, what would you like to say to people who are still on the sidelines for this? Hype us up for Fae, for A Court of Fae and Flowers.
Here's what I'm going to say. Is we've seen so many games and stories about heroes fighting against absurd odds and triumphing. We've seen the hero's journey. But now let's talk about the Fae and love and flowers and the things that make us feel powerful and special and important on the inside, not just the outside. Come to this with just a sense of watching your favorite people, watching incredibly good actors and storytellers and comedians getting weird with a different kind of story. And just show up with the sense that I gave them the weirdest brief and they went, all right, cool, bet. And took off in a direction that like none of us expected. And just give it a shot. It's decadent, it's glorious, it's romantic, it's too much, and there's flowers everywhere. What's not to love? I don't know if that sells anyone on anything, but I got to say the word flower like 96 times, so I'm living by that. Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Geek Peek. I hope you enjoyed. And before I let you go, I want to thank the individuals who went the extra mile and became my patrons. So, thank you so much to Arthur Morrill, Bob Prescott, Lexi Gardner, Cody Neville, Charlie Fisher, Stoat Dross, Laura Hamilton, Maggie, and Grace Bauer. If you want to join them, head on over to patreon.com/TheOrenCohen. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye for now.